At that point in time, Signet had sort of developed as kind of the classiest of the Regency romances. And there were some other little attempts, but with Signet, even their print runs, which were considered quite healthy then, were like, for the Regency, they were like 60,000. And then on the second book, I remember having, I got the plot idea, and I told Tilbury, we were down in Wall Street at a restaurant, and we were having lunch, and I said, well, Hillary, I said, the only thing is, you know, there was no sex in Regencies. Absolutely zippo nada. And I said, I've got a plot, Hillary, but, you know, I want sex in it. And it was at that point, which rarely happens, but it was an utter lack of noise in the restaurant. And everybody was like on point. And we got a good laugh out of that, and I told her what I wanted to do, and she grinned, and she said, go for it. And as a result, the print run jumped up to like 130,000.
That was the voice of Catherine Coulter, author of more than 80 novels, including some of the earliest Signet Regencies. We'll talk with Catherine about her time at the beginning of the Signet line, her work adding sex to Signet Regencies, and how she evolved into historical romances, and then, of course, into her longstanding career as a thriller writer.
This is Faded Mates. I'm Jennifer Prokop, a romance reader and editor.
I'm Sarah McLean. I read romance novels, and I write them.
You're about to hear a great conversation with Catherine Coulter. We're not going to spend a whole lot more time introducing it. We'll talk more on the back end. So without further ado, here is our conversation with Catherine Coulter.
We try really hard not to do all the fangirling, but I have to say The Sherbrooke Bride was like the book of my, like, of the greatest joy of my life when I read that book right when it came out. And so I'm really very delighted to be talking to you today. And thank you so much for making time for us.
Well, thank you for asking me. And I am so delighted that you like The Sherbrooke Bride. You know, it seems to be everybody's favorite, and it's a lemon book series.
Well, we're gonna get into why and why you think it is. We are in our fourth season of this podcast because we really love romance novels a whole lot. And over the last year, we have been interviewing many of the people who we believe built the house of romance, so to speak. And part of the reason why we're doing that, and I'm sure you've noticed this, is that romance doesn't get a whole lot of attention from the world at large. And we feel like it's really important to collect the history of the genre as much as we possibly can. So these conversations, what we're calling trailblazer recordings, are really conversations that are very far-reaching, and we want to talk about all things you. And I know that you have a book out next week, so we want to talk about that too. But hopefully you'll give us a sense of your life through writing and through romance. But we are both really thrilled to have you.
Well, thank you very much. Those were lovely things to say. And it's true. It's true. You know, I'll never forget when I was started writing. Oh, yes, I'm a writer. What do you write? Children's books? that was the most regular, you know. And then I think romance was next, you know. And you are almost embarrassed to say, well, yeah, you idiot. I mean, you know, I want to make some money. And women are 85% of the retail market. So excuse me.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So I think you guys are doing a wonderful thing and getting the history down. That's very good.
Catherine, can you tell us about how you started reading romance?
Well, my mother would read aloud to me when I was like 3 years old, and she read everything. But my very, very favorite author is Georgia Hare.
Yeah.
And I believe she died in 1972. And she was the one who started the Regency genre.
Yeah.
You knew, you've read her, right?
Yes, we know her.
Okay, yeah. So she, I still think she's the class act.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always in teaching, you know, always say you're allowed 3 exclamation points a book, okay? That's it. And she uses exclamation points after nearly every sentence.
Exactly.
But it's okay. It's the weirdest thing. You know, she does everything that you shouldn't do, and it's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So, which goes to, you know, goes to show there really are no rules.
Right.
But I don't think many people are on her level of just delight, sheer delight.
Mm-hmm.
What was your favorite, Georgian Hare?
Well, my favorite is Devil's Cub.
Gotcha. That was a good one.
But, I mean, which probably tracks very well with you'll be unsurprised that then I really fell in love with the Sherbrooke Bride and lots of other books with similar heroes there. So
we call them assholes. Someone redeemed Madonna that much.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, romance in many ways has not changed all that much, right? What about you, Catherine? What was your favorite hair?
The Grand Sophie.
Oh, of course. A classic.
Yeah, I just love the Grand Sophie. Uh-huh. I mean, she was such a go-getter. And Sylvester, you mm-hmm. know, or the Wicked Uncle. Talk about the classic asshole. Yeah, it's wonderful.
So, okay, so you are reading hair, and you're reading sort of voraciously. Tell us about your life at this point. So it's the, you know, where are you living in the world? How do you start thinking about actually putting pen to paper?
Well, as you know, everybody has a talent. And it just depends if you, A, find the talent, B, if you try to do something with it. And my talent was writing, but I never really recognized it. I just thought everybody could write a paper the night before and get an A.
Mm-hmm.
It was just very natural. And you really didn't understand why your classmates hated your guts. But they could do that. You know, they could do their own thing. So anyway, I never really thought about it. And then, you know, I got I went to the University of Texas and then got a master's degree at Boston College.
Uh-huh.
And at that point, my husband was in medical school in Columbia Presbyterian in Manhattan. And one thing, I've been extraordinarily lucky. You know how when you don't know if you should go one direction or another?
Uh-huh.
And then you might go the one direction and you think, well, what would have happened if I had, well, if I, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, at the same time, I was offered like an assistant professorship at a college in New Jersey. And then the other was a speech writing job on Wall Street in Manhattan. So I got to weigh both of them. My dad had been a professor at UT, and he would tell me that academia is the most, it's a viper pit. And he said, I've never seen anything like it. They cannot compare, businesses cannot compare to the viper pit that is academia.
Even Wall Street.
So,
yeah, wow.
So I chose Wall Street, and I wrote speeches. And for a guy who was the president of an actuarial firm, and your eyes are already glazing over, mine did. But I'll never forget in the interview, he was this kind of desiccated little old guy. He was very nice, and he was the president. And he said, I have to speak a lot. He says, I don't know why people ask me to speak because I'm not very good. He said, can you make me funny? And I said, sure, sure. So then at that time, my husband, as I said, was at Columbia Presbyterian. I saw him maybe 30 minutes a day over spaghetti.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading, 10 to 15 books a week in the evening. And then one night I said, I threw the book across the room and said, I can do better. And I thought that I was so, I thought that I was a trailblazer. But nobody ever done
and
that.
And now look.
Well, it turns out that maybe 60% of writers started that way.
Mm-hmm.
I can do better.
Mm-hmm.
So I went in and told my husband. And I have heard from so many women, and I just want to take them out and shoot them. oh, well, my husband won't let me do blah, 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 blah. Oh, no. Oh, shut up. Kick the jerk to the curb. And he said, sure, he says, and he took the next weekend off. And together we plotted the first and last book. But that was the last one he helped plot.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
And that was what was the name of that? The Autumn Countess, mm-hmm. which I later rewrote and made it into The Countess, which is much, much better because it's funny. Mm-hmm. And that's how it started.
That book was published in 1979. So were you reading, is that right around, was it very quickly published?
Well, what happened was, you know, since I was working full time, I would get up and write at like 4:30 and then get ready for work at 6:30. And I've always been a morning person, so that worked for me. And I took about a year. And I'll never forget, I rode the A train, it's the express, down to Wall Street. And there was this guy who worked at William Morrow. And so I said, oh, I'm writing a book. And yeah, right, honey. And I think at the time he wanted to get in my pants. And so he was all sorts of encouraging and nice. And what he did was he gave me the name of a freelance editor in the city. And she was also a model. And of course, at that time, nobody knew anything. And nobody knew anything until RWA was founded in the early 80s.
Right.
And that's when things started opening up. But at that time, it was a black hole publishing.
Yeah.
But I was at least in the center of it.
You were reading romance novels at this point.
Well, I read that, but I don't know if you know this, but I would say that a good 90%, maybe more, of all of my books have mysteries in them.
Right.
Right. Yes.
And so so I love mysteries. And so it was just a natural thing to have mysteries in it. So I read tons of mysteries, and there were the early bodice rippers, which were a hoot. You know, we have the 18-year-old virgin at the beginning. She loses her virginity. She's the hero. They're separated for 500 pages, and then they get together at the end. Oh, I love you. And they were wonderful. They were absolutely incredible. And so this editor said, well, let's go for it. And what she had was the top Regency publishers and the top editors. And at the time, it was New American Library. They had the class act with Signet Regencies.
Uh-huh.
And they were the only really class act in publishing. And so, you know, you can now take courses on writing query letters, you know, 101.
Yeah.
And I like wrote, dear Miss Boss, this is my book, you know, I hope you like it. No, it's so stupid. And again, you never know. There are usually three reasons why you're bought in a house, okay, back then and now. And number one is, a whole lot of writers, the majority of writers are always late. Writers under contract are always late turning in manuscripts. And so they're going, what are we going to do?
You just called out Sarah real hard, and it's pretty amazing.
Sarah, come here and let me smack
you. I'm sorry, Catherine. I'm sorry. Meet your deadline, Sarah.
You drive a house crazy because then they're having to do this, that, and the other. Or they might buy a book because they really, really love it.
Mm-hmm.
But those are the two main reasons. And I really don't know which one I was.
Oh, I know.
Well, Hillary Ross called me 3 days later, asked me out to lunch, and offered me a 3-book contract. So, I was very, very lucky. You know, she loves to tell the story how she pulled me up by my bootstraps out of a ditch. And that could have been true, I guess. And she still lives on the west side of New York.
Oh, that's great.
She was a character. And so it was very strange, but she loved my book. So what could I do but love her back?
Of course.
I didn't have an agent. And so when the 3-book contract was coming up, because I was such an idiot and didn't know anything, I asked my editor if she could recommend an agent. And so, of course, she recommended a very good friend of hers. And so I realized that I could have negotiated myself a better contract.
Mm-hmm.
So So that's how it all started.
And so Hillary Ross, did she found the New American Library? So for people who don't know, New American Library became Signet, correct?
No. New American Library was subsumed by Putnam.
Okay.
Okay?
Yep.
And then Putnam, of course, was subsumed by Random House. There used to be the big seven sisters in New York, and I think now we're down to four.
Right.
We won't go into Amazon, who just did wonderful things.
I am currently holding up an original copy of The Rebel Bride. Look down at your app right now, and you'll see the covers of the original Signet Regency. So could you talk a little bit about Signet as a line? Because we talk a lot here about category romance, but we haven't talked really at all about Signet, which is one of the reasons why we were so excited to have you come on, because we want to talk obviously about your historicals and how much of a powerhouse you had become. But in those early days at Signet, what was the vibe? What were people thinking there?
Well, at that point in time, Signet had sort of developed as kind of the classiest of the Regency romances. And there were some other little attempts by other houses, and I cannot remember any other imprints at this
time.
Sure. I just can't remember. But with Signet, even their print runs, which were considered quite healthy then, were like, for the Regency, they were like 60,000. And then what happened was, is on the second book, I remember I got the plot idea, and the second book, was that The Rebel Bride?
Yes.
Okay, and I told Hillary, we were down in Wall Street at a restaurant, and we were having lunch, and I said, well, Hillary, I said, the only thing is, there was no sex in Regencies. Absolutely zippo, nada.
Right.
And I said, I've got a plot, Hillary, but, you know, I want sex in it. And it was at that point, which rarely happens, but it was an utter lack of noise in the restaurant, and everybody was like on point, and we got a good laugh out of that. And I told her what I wanted to do, and she grinned and she said, "Go for it."
Oh, great!
And as a result, the print run jumped up to like 130,000.
Oh, look at that! They were like,
because everybody loved it.
Yeah,
and then then Joan Wolfe, who's a friend now, always, and she was at Signet at that time. And so she stuck her toes in. But that was really the start of putting sex in Regencies. It was not discreet. In those days, they truly were bodice rippers, and the sex could be extraordinarily explicit. And I did extraordinarily explicit sex, I think, through the Sherbrooke Bride series. And even toward the end of that, I just kind of lost interest in it and really spent much more time on the plot and the characters because I'd read so many books. And I'd go to conferences where editors would say, now you want to have a sex scene every three chapters or every 20 pages or whatever. And it was like it was gratuitous. And that's when I realized you don't want anything gratuitous in a book because it pulls the reader out of the book, which it did me. And I'm a reader, big reader. So what are you doing? Who cares? You know, these are just parts and it doesn't mean anything. In other words, most of the time, the sex scenes did not forward the plot. They detracted. They were just blah. They were just thrown in. So, and I just kind of lost interest in it. And so that's when I just kind of went down and stopped with explicit sex. And most people didn't. In fact, today, again, I wish that people writing romance would not depend so heavily on this really, really explicit sex because it's not necessary. And if you're going to do a sex scene, you want to have humor in it. It shouldn't be body part A and body part B and, oh, this is so serious and blah, blah, blah. No. You know, blah. Anyway, all right, I'm now off my bandwagon.
That's okay. I love a bandwagon.
This week's episode of Faded Mates is sponsored by Cara Dion, author of Indiscreet.
All right, here we go. Are you ready?
I'm ready. On her 21st birthday, our heroine Min is stood up at the opera by some jerk, but there just happens to be somebody in the seat next to her.
Very handsome, I'm sure.
So handsome. They have an instant attraction. They bond over their love of music and opera, and they have a like one night stand, as one does. They leave the opera immediately and have a one night stand, Moonstruck style.
Moonstruck style. I
exactly.
love it.
Exactly. So, except Jen, what do you think happens the next day when Min goes to her university opera program?
Is he her professor, Sarah?
Oh my God, he's totally her professor. Totally. So, it
you
gets...
You could not be more delighted by this, and I love
my
it.
My favorite. This is my favorite. I cannot wait to read this. This one is for anybody who, like me, loves a professor-student romance. This is very forbidden. It's all about secrets, and there's a little bit of an age gap in here, if you like an age gap romance. And all I have to say about this is it sounds freaking great. There's a secret... A dark shadow from Min's past makes their entanglement even more complicated. And this is my favorite part. And the music that drove them both forward and bound them together could also be the thing to tear them apart.
Amazing. You can find Indiscreet in print, ebook, and on KU. You can find out more about the author at caradion.author on Instagram. Thank you to Cara Dion for sponsoring this week's episode of Faded Mates.
So you wrote seven signets and seven regencies, and then you moved to what you call historicals. So,
well, no, I call them hystericals.
Oh, amazing.
I wrote long hystericals. So, and that was interesting because at that point, after I finished that contract, I had the brain to say, I think I need a real agent.
Yeah.
And not the editor's best friend.
Uh-huh.
I had met Peter Heggie, who was the secretary of the Authors Guild in New York. So I gave him a call. We had moved to San Francisco because my husband had was doing his residency here at the University of California, San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
And of course, a writer is totally portable. And at that time, my company, I was kind of the golden lass. And so they even moved me out here to do a job that I had no knowledge that I couldn't do because it was like installing a computer system on the West Coast. Okay.
Right.
Honey, I can't even do Zoom, all right? So anyway, that's neither here nor there. But I called Peter Heggie from San Francisco and told him I wanted a female agent.
Mm-hmm.
And so he gave me the name of two women, and then he gave me one man. And so when I came back to New York on business and so forth, I met these people, and I swear to you, I do not even remember the women's names. I went to William Morris. They're a great big agency in New York. And I met with the guy he recommended. His name was Robert Gottlieb. And he'd been out of the mailroom, and that is still spelled M-A-L-E. and he was in kind of this closet with no window. He'd been out of the mailroom for like 6 months. And we talked, and I said, what do you want to do when you grow up? And he said, I want to be on the board of directors of William Morris by the time I'm 45. So I never forgot that.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, he became my agent. He absolutely enraged Hillary, absolutely enraged. And the head of the house at New American Library had to get involved to calm things down. And my darling, this is over a $10,000 book advance.
Mm-hmm. There,
I mean, because we're back in 1980.
Sure.
Okay, 1981. And so that worked out. Robert and I have been together longer than all of his marriages. But I give great gifts. I give great gifts.
So you're the reason why.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. And I'll never forget this. Just to the side, I'll never forget he called me in 1987. And he was hyperventilating. He was so excited. And he was on the board of directors of William Morris when he was 37.
Oh, that's great news. That.
Yeah, so it's a great story. And then he got outsharked by Michael Ovitz in 2000 and then started Trident Media. And so that's, you know, that started a new chapter of his life. And he also married Olga, who was an orienteer at Olympic in Russia.
Wow.
Oh, he's a Russian fanatic. Anyway, and so they're still married. They have two grown kids, well, almost grown kids now. So everything is good with him. And as I say, we've been together for how long? I mean, years.
That's
and
a
years
long time.
And years, well over 30 years. In the mid-80s, Bob DiFiorio, who was on the sales team for New American Library, he became the head of the president. And he and I met, and I really didn't know who he was, but we just had an immediate relationship. And so he was in part, he started pushing me immediately. And I'll never forget, it was a Fire Song. It was the first, it was the first book in the Medieval series. And they decided... He decided that they were going to have a Fire Song perfume. So they attached these little vials of perfume to all the books and shrink wrapped them. The problem was,
oh my God,
they were shipped. They were shipped in trucks and then, you know, whatever.
Oh.
And so the perfume turned horrible.
Oh no.
I must have gotten 2,000 emails saying, what? Not emails, letters saying, what?
Oh, no.
that was so fun.
And still you survived it, Catherine. The books must have been great.
Oh, things just, you know, there are so many just cute little things that happen through the years, you know.
That song series, I mean, I think I read every one of those books a dozen times. I would get one and then just read them straight through
them
and then immediately start again. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit just in general about what it was like writing. When we talk now about, when we look back on the 70s, the 80s, the early 90s, that period of time really felt like the heyday of romance. Like, it's never been like that since.
It was the golden age, I call it. It
and
really was the golden age.
Do you feel like you knew at the time what you were a part of?
Oh, no, you never do. I look back now and realize it was the golden age. And, of course, this was pre-Amazon. And and everybody was just, I mean, the print runs were outrageous. They were over a million copies. And
That's wild.
It was a wild time. But you really, you know, you're writing, and then a book comes out, and it does like this, and when we get a contract, and we're going to conferences, and you just don't think, well, I'm a part of the golden era, because at the time, you know, you're still a part of it.
Yeah.
And you're not looking back. You're not looking back. You're looking forward always.
And what are the tell us a little bit about what the readers are like at this point. Like, what are these conferences like?
I think the last one was an RWA. But when I compare it to the ones throughout the years, they're not that different at all.
Okay.
They're really not. I will tell you, there were the big writers, you know, like Janet Daly was huge then, absolutely huge. And I remember she would travel to a conference with her handlers. Okay, there'd be her personal handler, and then there'd be somebody from the publishing house, and then they would answer most of the questions. But in the other workshop, by the unsuperstars, you had then, as you had now, is people will stand up and say, okay, you want to do this, 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 and this, and don't do that, and don't do this. And people are out, they want to get published. That's what they want more than anything in the universe. And they're taking wild notes.
Yeah.
And I can remember thinking then, this is nuts. Uh-huh. What you want to do, darling, is to write a good story. Forget the rest of this shit. Okay?
Yeah.
And I just had a few do's and don'ts. But mainly, you know, even back then, I'd say, sit your butt in a chair and write.
Yeah.
You cannot edit a blank page. And, you know, it doesn't matter if you write crap. It really doesn't, because now you have something to work on. And but people, they would preach. There was a lot of preaching because I'm published and you're not. And it was just, and I don't know if it's still like that today. It was in, you know, the last time I was at a conference, it was more or less like that. And these were kind of superstars like, what's her face? She retired and stopped writing. Laverne Spencer. So you had, again, a huge disparity between the superstars and the people who desperately wanted to be published. This has been true forever.
Yeah.
Forever.
So can we, while we're talking about authors, other authors, could you give us a sense of, like, who was your community? So you obviously, you're very busy. You have a day job, a high-powered day job. Your husband is studying.
No, I quit my job in 1981 because I could no longer afford to work.
Right. It's the dream, right? Right,
yeah.
Of course.
Yeah, so I was full-time writer from 1981, got a computer in 1981. It was $10,000. It was a Vector.
Wow.
And it had a 5-inch floppy disk and took a week to learn how to do it, but I corrected that, knew it. But it got rid of all the crap, because if you made mistakes before on an electric typewriter, you had to retype an entire page.
Right.
But, you know, you just press a little button and crap's gone. So it was it was an amazing, amazing thing. Graham Greene, another writer, I'll never forget, he said in the mid-80s, you're not a real writer if you use a computer. And I was like, you idiot.
Oh, Graham. That's cute, Graham.
Oh, Lord. So in 1985, I was in Houston. I had a couple of political writer friends who sort of dropped out a little bit later, dropped out of the picture.
Uh-huh.
But in 1985, I was in Houston, and this is when Rebecca Brandywine was really big.
Oh, yeah.
And her mother, so she really wanted to have lunch with me, and I said, well, this would be fun to see what she has to say. She was an agent, Rebecca's mom. And so then, I'll never forget, she kissed me off for somebody else to have lunch with.
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of looking around, and I see an empty chair at this table. And I go up and I say, can I sit here? And we met, and this was Linda Howard and Iris Johansson and Kate Hooper.
The whole crew.
We became best friends at that point, and we have stayed that way forever.
That's nice. That's great.
So, yeah.
And my gosh, and all four of you have just, you're still all writing. It, you know, that's rare when you make a group of friends when you're young at the job and you're all still there.
Yeah. And everybody became successful.
Uh-huh.
Everybody, all four of us, which was very good to happen, because you wouldn't want one or two people not as successful as you when we go on trips and stuff together. So it worked out very, very well. I don't think there was, you know, no jealousy. Everybody was very supportive of everybody else. So it worked.
So around this time, one of the things that's interesting is you really had a productive period in the 80s where you were writing historicals. You wrote a few, like, silhouette intimate moments. You were clearly starting to transition into doing kind of mystery thriller. How did this, like, did you feel like you got guidance through this process, or was this something that you just really were like, these are the things I want to write?
Well, that's a good question. I remember, I think it was in 1985, and we were in Europe on a train in Switzerland, and this entire plot came into my brain, which had never happened before, and it was contemporary. I said, go away, I don't want to write contemporary, go away, and it didn't. So I wrote it when I got home, and I realized it was a short contemporary romance, and I had no idea what to do with it. So I called a friend, Debbie Gordon, who's no longer writing, but she was very big at that time at Silhouette. And she said, okay, she said, this is what you tell Robert, this is what he wants to ask for. And so I did, and he did, and I was with Leslie Wanger, and there and so it was a three book series: Aftershocks, The Aristocrat, and Afterglow. And she said, "Okay, now I've got the A's. What are the B's going to be?" And I said, "Honey, there ain't no more water in this well." And so it was just those three, but they were fun. They were like a little dessert, a little dish in sorbet. Because they're only about 65,000 words, as opposed to 100,000, 110,000. And no, there was no guidance in 1988. It was. The idea came to me. It wasn't a plot then. It was just an idea. Just to back up 1 second, this was False Pretenses, and it was my very first hardcover, and it was a romantic suspense. You know, not a suspense thriller, a romantic suspense. And the heroine was a concert pianist. And, they, you know, when you change genres, the most important thing you want to do is to eliminate as many unknowns as you can. And I picked the piano because I'm a pianist. Oh. My mother was a concert pianist organist, and I knew everything about it. I knew all the music. I knew what I was talking about.
Yeah.
So we're in New York City, and then it was, of course, a mystery. And but it was a romantic suspense because you can't be a romance unless there's a central core that's a man and a woman getting together in a relationship. And then everything else can be around it. Doesn't matter. It can be, you know, Mars, or it can be murders, or it can be anything you want. But to be a romance, you have to have the central core being the relationship. And so that's what it was. So they wanted to push it as this. I don't even remember. I said, no, it's a romantic suspense. So they said, okay. And that was the first hardcover. And then I wrote probably four or five more contemporary romantic suspense, which were a lot of fun to do. So anyway, I was writing probably three or four books a year. And, you know, it's easy. Now, of course, I write, never mind, because now I'm an elder. But anyway, I was writing a whole lot of books a year, and I'll never forget. Then Putnam had bought, as I said, New American Library. And the head of Putnam was Phyllis Grand.
Yes.
She's probably the best woman publisher she was in the world. I absolutely would kill for her. She would call me up and say, "Catherine, I need a quote." And I said, "What would you like me to say?" Whatever she wanted from me, she got, because she was absolutely wonderful. And they went back to New York, and there was this big round table at the plaza in the tea room there in the court. And I was introduced to my new editor. And they made an offer that was just outrageous, absolutely outrageous. I will not tell you what it is, but it was outrageous. And so I went there. And what they wanted was the hysterical romances. And so
the hysterical romances.
Well, I try to make them funny. I really do. Oh, one thing I wanted to add: talk about luck. Those first Regency, six or seven Regencies, I went back and rewrote them.
Yeah, I want to talk about that.
And I made them so much better. I turned them into historical romances, and I made them funny. And then they hit the New York Times, you know, because they were no longer Regencies.
This week's episode of Faded Mates is sponsored by Lumi Labs, creators of microdose gummies, which deliver entry-level doses of THC that help you feel just the right amount of good. You know what I needed to feel just the right amount of good recently, Sarah?
Tell me.
when I was getting on a plane.
Oh, yeah.
I think airports are just sort of like stressful places now. And I found that I took a gummy before we like got off to Ed O'Hare and went through security. And it just was like a nice experience for me. I just felt like sort of my anxiety about the plane and all of the like hustle bustle of the airport was just a little, took the edge off ever so slightly. It was delightful.
I love it.
If you're interested in hearing more about microdosing, go to microdose.com and you can learn all about microdose gummies. They deliver a perfect entry-level dose of THC that help you feel just the right amount of good. And you can use the code FADEDMATES to get free shipping and 30% off of your first order.
Links can be found in show notes as always, but again, that's microdose.com, code FADEDMATES. And thanks to Lumi Labs for sponsoring the episode. Did you go to Putnam and say, I want to rewrite these?
Yeah. I said, I really would like them because I think that they're kind of a bummer to me now. And I think I can make them 1,000% better and make them longer and richer and funnier and make the, you know, and all that. So, and they said, sure, go for it.
That's incredible. And so what is that process like? So this is the mid-80s, so it's only 5 or 6 years. It's sort of,
yeah.
It's not even a decade since they came out. So what was that process like as a writer to revise, essentially, yourself? So,
right,
you know, at a distance.
It was easy. It was very, very easy because the book was already there.
Yeah.
So I didn't have to worry about, oh, dear, is that plot going to work here and there? No, I didn't have to worry about it. All I had to worry about was, let's make this really, really fun.
Mm-hmm. Was it driven by, like, I'm a better writer now? I've had more practice? Or the rules don't apply to me in the same way anymore? Or both?
Both.
Okay.
Both. And, of course, Regency's, ever since Joan and I were big at Signet, Regency started changing.
Mm-hmm. Well, they got sexier.
Yeah. And that was because of Joan and me, which was mm-hmm. and I can take credit for that, and so does she.
Good.
So that was fun.
So you're at the Plaza. They won historicals.
They were historicals. So in a period of 3.5 years, I wrote 3 trilogies.
Wow.
The Wyndham Legacy, the Legacy Trilogy, the Fire Trilogy, and another trilogy that escapes my brain at the moment. But it never happened in my life, but I was burned to my toes.
Yeah, I'm
absolutely
sure.
Burned to my toes. And so it was in 1995, and I was at a family reunion in Texas. And my sister, who has never done this before or since, walked up to me and said, have you ever heard of a little town on the coast of Oregon called The Cove? They make the world's greatest ice cream and bad stuff happens. And I just went on point. You know, I said, oh my heavens. And so I told my my editor, and of course I understood their position. I mean, if it ain't broke, why fix it?
Sure.
But you know, I really dug in my heels.
Well, they'd milked you for 9 books in 3 years.
Yeah.
But at that point I had enough power. Yeah. I said, give me a chance. And so then that's when I wrote The Cove. And then when they got it, they wanted to make it into a hardcover. And I said, no. I said, failure is well and good, but you don't want to fail in hardcover, and who knows how this book will be received.
Yeah.
So they brought it out in paperback in 1996, I believe. And it really did extraordinarily well. I was very happy for that. And then the publisher called and I said, well, when's the next one in the series? And I said, what series? What are you talking about? And I kid you not, this will happen. And it happened. And there was this voice in the back of my head. And he said, Catherine, what about me? And it was Dylan Savage.
Uh-huh.
Mm. Yeah.
And so then the Maze was basically Sherlock's book. And this is the book they got together. And then after that, you had The Target, which is one of my all-time favorite books, with the Hunt, you know, Ramsey Hunt and Emma. And I'll never forget, you know, I wrote international thrillers with J.T. Ellison.
Yeah.
Six of them. And I'll never forget, J.T. told me, he said, well, a series isn't really a series until book four. And I was kind of, you know, laughing at her. She was perfectly right. She was totally right. The fourth book, The Edge, started that series. And then it became, then it just went from there. So, and at that point, I was writing one historical a year and one FBI thriller a year. And it worked very, very well because they're such disparate genres and your brain gets unconstipated. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Sure.
And then it's just been about, I guess, about 4 or 5 years ago, I could just do one book a year, and that was fine. That was perfectly fine.
Yeah.
And it's been wonderful. It's really, I feel blessed, very, very blessed and very, very lucky. And I've met so many fascinating writers and publishers over the years. And as I say, Robert and I are still together.
Pretty amazing.
He'll call up and talk about stuff. You know, it's wonderful.
Can we return maybe to the Sherbrooke Bride for a second?
Sure.
So Sarah talked about it being like one of her favorites. You mentioned that so many readers still talk about it. So
yeah.
Is this, when we're talking about romance, is this, why do you think this is the book that so many romance readers connected to? Is it like the primordial Catherine Coulter book? Like, what made it the one?
I think that everybody, women, I think that women respond viscerally to a real alpha male who's an asshole, basically. But he's a real alpha male. And it's how the woman, he ends up worshiping her toenails, you know? And I think women, it's on a visceral level. They love that. They're just fascinated by the alpha male. That's my own feeling.
And I also think I was speaking to a friend of mine earlier today about how we were interviewing you, Catherine, and my friend Sophie Jordan, who also writes historicals, was saying that we talked about how you really mastered the grovel in your books. I mean, your hero, you put them through the ringer at the end because they've been such assholes. That is a great joy.
I mean, you're not going to find Alan Alda character as a woman's hero. Let's get real here, you know. A beta male is of no interest to anybody except fixing your computer.
But truthfully, I think that the magic of a Catherine Coulter book is that sort of sense, as you said, worshiping her to her toenails only once he has been clubbed over the head with how terrible he's been to her. And that is, it's that punishment, too.
It's discipline. And men love to be disciplined, even if they don't admit it. You know, they just love it. They love it. On the other hand, the youngest brother, Tyson, who starred in The Scottish Bride. That's probably my favorite because it was such a, it was such, he evolved. He evolved so much and he was such a good man, you know? And so I take it back about the alpha male because Tyson was absolutely amazing to me. I loved him.
I mean, was it a challenge to write someone who then was really different?
Oh, no. I loved him from the moment that book started when he was dealing with his three children. And he didn't know what to do with them. And he was, you know, he was just, he evolved so much and turned into such a kind, wonderful person who was never an asshole. He was just stupid. And he wasn't stupid. That's the wrong word. He was just caught up in this view, in this worldview of himself that was so limiting. It was so very limiting. And his brothers always made fun of him, you know. And I'll never forget in the beginning of Sherbrooke Bide when they're having their quarterly bastard meeting.
So
and I, that just came out of my fingertips. I said, "What are you doing?" And then Tyson goes and runs out. You know, he wants none of that. But that was great sport.
So as you think about your career, as you sort of look back, and I mean, obviously forward as well. I mean, you show no signs of stopping. Are there moments that you can sort of pinpoint of particular challenge as a writer or from the genre perspective? Is there some lesson that you were sort of hard learned that you can share with us?
But let me just say, I do not believe in writer's block.
Okay.
I never have. What I believe in, it's a bad plot. And it happened one time, and it was an FBI thriller. I don't even remember which one. But I got to page 85, and it had been a bear. And then all of a sudden, it stopped cold. And I realized, okay, this is a shitty plot. And so I threw the 85 pages in the garbage can and started over. Because if you're a writer, you have to be honest with yourself and what you're producing. And when a book stops in its tracks and the characters look at you and say, please go away, you know it's a bad plot. And it's up to you not to try to keep forcing it. And the trick is you have to trust that there's another plot, you know, in the parking lot in your brain that's going to come driving out. And it will. And it did. So that was really the only time, I'll never forget this might be interesting to writers. With The Cove, when I first wrote it, and my editor was the head of Berkeley, Leslie Gelman,
uh-huh.
a wonderful, wonderful editor and leader. And so when I first wrote The Cove, it was a brand new genre for me. And I wrote the entire plot out in the first 50 pages. And you know how she dealt with it? She called me up, she says, and she wanted to see what I was doing. And she called me back and she was saying, Catherine, okay, now you know what the plot is. Tell me the story.
Oh, I
and
love
that's
that.
All she said. That's all
a good
she said.
Piece of advice.
I had written the whole thing out in the first 50 pages so the reader would know everything.
Yeah.
And then she was just so matter of fact. Now tell me the story. And I did.
Amazing.
So a good editor, you've got to be lucky in your editors too. I know some authors who have had 9 editors
uh-huh.
at the same house. And this is never good. This is always sucky. So I've been very, very lucky in my editors.
Who is your editor now, Catherine?
My editor now is a brand new person. I'm with William Morrow, and her name is Mae Chin. She's fairly hands-off. I'd had David Heifel, and he had the absolute gall to retire and move to Tuscany.
How dare.
You know,
That's terrible.
I was just cursing him. Yeah, don't you dare do it. Anyway, so he said, I promise that I have spoken to May and she will do very good by you. Please trust me, Catherine, and don't shoot her. she's very kind. And to be very honest, my husband is basically my editor
uh-huh.
on the FBI thrillers. He can't write his way out of a paper bag, but he's an incredible editor.
That's great.
Since I've become an elder, you know, I slowed down. So I had decided with Reckoning, the book that's coming out next week, I don't want to be under contract anymore. I want to just write what I want to write, and then I'll sell it. And then they said, oh, please, blah, 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 blah. And I said, okay, but I don't want, make it 2 years. Okay, anything you want, not a problem. And so I'm on page 80, and the outline is due a year from today. From this month.
There you go. Well, so there you go. You can't stop.
You can't stop. But, you know, I guess 5 years ago, I was asked if I was a pantser or a plotzer, and I didn't know what they were talking about. but I'm definitely a pants, are you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which means you're always rewriting and rewriting and changing. Yeah. And
constantly.
Backward build up, we call it. Constantly, constantly,
Which is why it terrified me that you rewrote The Rebel Bride. So I was like, oh God, I can never go back. I'll throw it all out and start over.
No. You don't understand. The book was there.
Yes.
And the plot was there. So there,
right.
was no, there were no hurries. Now you're just putting on different tree ornaments.
Nice.
And different lights. I mean, it was wonderful.
I bet. Catherine, tell us a little bit. I want to sort of just talk a little about the shift from Catherine Coulter, you know, romance trailblazer to Catherine Coulter, real powerhouse in thrillers. Was it an easy transition in the world? Meaning, did thrillers welcome you? I know that, you know, it's tough. It's tough to be a woman writing thrillers in the thriller world. And I'm wondering, did you have that experience or was it very generally welcoming?
That's a very good observation. And the absolute truth is, I never thought about it.
That's good.
The first time, when they put, it took a while, they put the second book, The Maze, in hardcover. And it made the Times, but it wasn't in the top five. But then they just kept getting stronger and stronger. And by the time I went to actually, I'd never been to BoucherCon. I was just not interested. And all my friends said it's they didn't like it. But anyway, Thriller Fest in New York City was a different matter. And by the time I started going to Thriller Fest, the FBI series was really well grounded. And was doing well. It wasn't like the third, fourth, or fifth book. It was like the eighth or ninth book in that series. And there was never a problem. It was very welcoming. I really like Lee Childs. I just met a whole bunch of really, really nice people.
Yeah.
Men as well as women, like Lisa Gardner, who was such a sweetheart.
And I
can't remember other names at the point because I haven't been in like 3 years. But it was just very, very welcoming. And they made me, the first year I went, it wasn't because I was interested. They had made me the interview of the year or something. I can't remember what they called it, where you're in front and you're interviewed by somebody, whatever. Anyway. So I just never experienced that. But again, a lot of people, men and women, who go to Thriller Fest who are either unpublished or still in like the B rung, I do not know what their experiences are. Anybody I ever met, you know, was wonderful. And I'm not a jerk, you know. I'll talk to everybody. It didn't matter. So it was just never an issue at the very beginning. You know, oh, do you write children's books and that kind of crap?
Uh-huh.
But it just didn't matter. And people would say, "Oh, you wrote romance." I said, "Yes." You know, because I'm not ashamed of them at all. I love them. I wish I could still write two books a year. One hysterical. When I couldn't write two books a year, that's when I went to the novellas with Grace and Sherbrooke.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Are you familiar with those at all?
Yes. I've read them all.
Oh, well, you're so wonderful. Well, the sixth one will be out in October because Nicole, who is God, and she heads up the digital division at Trident, which is Robert's agency. Oh, she's incredible. She is absolutely incredible. If you ever, her name is Nicole Robson, R-O-B-S-O-N. If you ever need anything, anything to do, she's at the Trident Media Group in New York City, and she is smart, she's kind, she knows everything. So she would help you without a problem. Anyway, she likes to put them near Halloween because they're woo-woo.
Well, there is, I mean, that is the piece of the Coulter puzzle that I think is so fascinating as a writer, just looking at your career. You really have told so many different kinds of stories.
Right.
And for somebody, for writers who are often told in a genre, right, where we are often told, like, stay in your lane, the idea, I think part of the reason why the Sherbrooke Bride shattered everything I had thought historical was, is because there was that ghosty piece.
The Virgin Bride, yeah.
Yeah. And you'd never expect it. But, I mean, I really feel like
she now lives in the past. I love it. You know, she found her happy ever after.
Right. I mean, I think that there is, if you've never read Catherine Coulter's romances, I think there are so many different avenues to take. Mm-hmm. And that's really remarkable. You're a trailblazer. There's a reason why we reached out.
Well, you are so sweet. And if you're kissing up, you're doing it very well.
Thank you. I'm really not. I really do think your books are great.
Yeah. And we love the genre and we love to people. We love romance so much. We just love romance.
Well, if you love romance so much, still, I very rarely read contemporary romances because... Uh-huh. I have found them still to be, we call it popping dicks. And, I mean, you tell a story and get rid of the stuff that's extraneous. It's like people are using horrible language. I stopped about 12 books ago. I never use bad language anymore because it's gratuitous. You don't need it. There's always another way to say it without saying fuck. There is another way to say that. And sometimes that's appropriate, and I have to grind my teeth not to do it. But again, so many books, you have gratuitous bad language. You've read them. And you have gratuitous sex scenes. Stop it. Just stop it. Tell a good story.
Can I ask a question? Do you think that there is a similar issue with gratuitous violence in thrillers?
Of course. Anything that's unnecessary is gratuitous. If you want to talk about ripping somebody's guts out and eating them, well, good luck. I'm not going to read your frickin' book. I'm not going to. Why? Right. Why do I care?
Yeah.
You know? So you killed this person because of this, that, and the other reason. Get on with the story. Yeah, gratuitous violence. Those three things are the major three. You hit it on the nail. You hit the nail on the hammer there. Hit the nail on the head with a hammer. Okay, love that. I just hate gratuitous stuff. And in the romances, it's still rife. And I don't know why this is. I don't understand. It would seem to me that the genre would have weeded this out over the years, but it has not. Anyway, my soapbox is now in the closet again.
Catherine, I wonder, we end all of our conversations this way. So, I hope you'll humor us. When we talk about trailblazers, we often come to the table with, a preconceived idea of the answer to this question. But what is the hallmark of a Catherine Coulter novel? What is the thing you leave on the table every time?
Boy, you guys are just full of good questions. let me just do the address, the FBI series.
Yeah.
Is my promise to the reader is there is always justice at the end.
Sure.
And I will not kill off a major character. But there has got to be, it's always a good ending, justice. We always have justice at the end. So there's no existential crap going on that leaves the reader wanting to shriek. No, it's done. This chapter now is done, handled. Although I do bring characters back a lot.
And what about the romances?
The romances, I would say that after I rewrote those first six books, I realize the trick really is to have as much humor as you can. And if you're dialogue driven, which I hope most writers are, because after a page and a half, And this is another thing romance novels do. Wow. Page and a half of introspection, and you're already lost. You can't even remember what the character asked. The character asks a question, and we have a page and a half of introspection. What? What are you doing? Anyway, if you can say something aloud, you say it aloud. And if you can do it, have humor. If you have humor, just about anything will fly. So I didn't do it in all the books, but there is humor whenever I can do it. And they're going to end well.
Yeah. Wow.
But everybody's going to say that they're going to end well, because a romance novel, that's what the reader expects. These two people are going to go through the ringer, and then they're going to end out on the other side, and they're going to be mated for life. That is why women really like romance, because it's filled with hope.
Yeah.
It's filled with hope. No matter what you endure in all of this, it's going to work out.
Well, thrillers too.
Right. Justice
people
is served.
Often comment on, oh, so many romance novelists end up writing thrillers. And the reality is, it makes perfect sense to us that's a possible career arc, because justice and hope being served are, you know, they're both happily ever afters in a certain sense, right?
They are. And they're, well, not, they're happily ever afters for that one plot.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There are other things going on, of course. But no, you're perfectly right. You're perfectly right. There's hope and there's justice, and things are going to be okay. And I promise you that. No matter what I do to those characters, it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
Did you happen to get an ARC of Reckoning?
No, but I'm going to ask for one.
We can ask Karen for them.
Well, I prefer that you bought it.
I will
okay.
do that too.
Fine, we'll do that too.
I'll take those orders. That's fine.
Well, there's a surprise at the end, because readers have been bugging me about this for a long time.
Ooh.
And I'm not going to tell you what it is.
Okay.
Great.
I don't know if it's great, but we'll see.
I'm sure it will be. And so, Catherine, one last question. As you think about your, you know, more than 80 books, I think we're at now.
I'm on 88.
Number 88.
Wow.
So,
yeah.
In 88 books, we've talked about books that your readers have really loved, that have resonated. Is there a book that you think back on and think that was really fabulous? That's the one I wish everybody could read forever.
That's, yes, indeed. My own personal favorite is Beyond Eden. I wrote it in the 90s, and it's my very, very own personal favorite. That book moved me profoundly.
Why?
The heroine, Lindsay. Her attitude on life and how she deals with what she goes through, which is a whole lot. Have you guys read it?
I don't think I have read this one.
No, I don't think so.
Okay, well, it's a contemporary, and it's got a mystery in it, but again, it's a romantic suspense, okay? And we have the hero in it is what you want every hero to be, down to his toenails,
mm-hmm.
which are, you know, he buffs. Well, I don't know if he does, but it will move you, I hope, profoundly. And it ended up right.
Wow. You know, it's amazing.
A lot of that was amazing.
I mean, a lot, aside from like that whole conversation. What's amazing is like a lot of these interviews, it's as though no one has ever asked these women to talk about their life in romance. I mean, I think a lot of people have not been asked
probably,
about that.
Right.
And so the stories are just wild.
One of the things that is like really persistent in this generation of authors that we've interviewed is kind of their success feels really predicated on whether or not they were lucky enough to find good people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really clear from talking to Catherine Coulter that she felt really lucky and found a lot of really good people, not just friends, author friends, not just her husband, but in publishing itself.
Yeah, an agent who she felt supported by, editors
right.
who she felt were really doing the best work for the books.
And I loved that story about the cove, about when she, the first book. I mean, I loved the whole story about her sister giving her the idea, et cetera. But also I loved that she went to Leslie Gelbman, who we've talked about before because Leslie was Nora Roberts's editor and was J.R. Ward's editor. So,
yeah.
And Jane Ann Krentz's editor. So, I mean, somebody who we've is in the ether as an important voice in romance. But when she talked about Leslie Gelbman responding and saying, okay, so this is the plot, but where's the story?
Now tell me the story.
It's so remarkable when you're right. I mean, an editor just could have easily said, this is not going to work for you.
And then, right, she doesn't get to travel down that path. So I think that part I was really interested in because it feels like, and I think this is, you know, you obviously are in publishing in a way I'm not. It is clear to me when I talk to people, to other authors now, that there's still a real sense of, you know, it takes a village to be a successful author in publishing. And who is that village and who's supporting you and, you know, or your awareness of them as people that have helped you along the way. And how long is standing? You know, her talking about Robert Gottlieb's many, you know, his kids and his wife and the way that
yes, she's outlasted so many people in his life. And it these relationships, it feels different in a lot of ways. I mean, obviously, I'm a writer, so I don't know what it's like to be other things. But I did for many years have a job in corporate America. And the relationships don't feel quite so personal in those jobs. I mean, but this long-standing editorial relationship, long-standing agent relationships, these relationships where somebody knows your kids and knows your family. And we talk about books being orphaned, authors being orphaned by their editors, and it really does feel that way.
You know, we now are smart enough and record these kind of right after we're done.
Immediately after the conversation.
Just got after the, you know, and so it's interesting because the first thing you think of is sometimes not necessarily, but I was really interested in her talking about the golden age of romance. Like, of course, you wouldn't realize it at the time, but looking back that she could say, like, of course.
Well, I mean, just the story, the way the story goes where, you know, she went to a lunch at the Plaza with, like, sales, and they offered her a giant deal for more historicals, like, at this lunch at the Plaza. I mean,
That doesn't happen anymore.
Gone are the days. I mean, maybe it happens for someone else. Colleen Hoover probably gets lunch at the Plaza. I actually don't know if you can have lunch at the Plaza anymore. But the point is, you know, it really does feel like there was this moment in time when so many writers were just powerhouses. And now it, what's interesting is I was thinking as she was talking, oh, well, you know, there is something going on right now, right? There are writers who are powerhouses right now.
Yes.
But it feels like many, many fewer.
She talked about getting letters, right, from her readers. But powerhouses now sometimes are grassroots, right?
The like readers, up their TikTok.
Yes, right. The readers have decided that this person is a powerhouse.
But she didn't talk very much about readers.
No.
For her, it was very much like she seemed to feel as though it was a top-down kind of. She was
part of the publishing ecosystem, right?
Uh-huh.
And I thought that was also just really interesting to consider the way our relationship with authors have changed. But at the same time, like, right, she's really plugged into Facebook. She updates it every day. Like, this is not someone who is disinterested in the reader's experience. But just how that's one big thing that seems very clearly different.
Yeah. I was grateful to hear her talk about burnout because it's something that I think a lot of us are thinking about right now. You know, 9 books in 3 years in the early 90s.
That was a lot.
That is a ton of work. And it feels like that was a huge ask from her publisher. And I'm glad that she talked about just like her brain kind of just fizzing out and needing to have a moment of something completely different to rejuvenate herself. I loved a lot of that conversation because I think that she is one of those people who made a career of writing as a writer and has evolved by virtue of, luckily, her own passions and the way the market demanded. Well,
and then that was interesting because, right, like we see the clear evolution, right, from romance to romantic suspense to kind of thrillers, right? Some of that had to do with now I can just write one book a year or one book every 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I was also really interested in what would drive her to go back and then rewrite books.
Oh, yeah.
That was fascinating because
she's a writer, right? She's a craftsman. We've talked about this before that, and I mean, I don't want to put words in her mouth because we didn't ask her this, but we've talked about this sort of some people think of themselves as artists and some people think of themselves as craftsmen. And I mean, it feels like a true craftsman's choice to say, like, that book bums me out, which is what she said.
Yeah. Well, and I think there further evidence of that is the discussion of you can't revise if there's nothing on the page, right? Uh-huh. The first draft does not matter.
Right.
That's just the raw material, right? Like, and that's the thing. The artist is like, okay, I've got one shot with this huge block of, you know, clay to make my sculpture.
Uh-huh.
But writers are different, right? And I thought that was also really interesting to hear her process. And it doesn't surprise me at all. It's a bit of a segue that someone who herself is so funny and so sharp and so, you know, kind of observationally on point would think that humor is a really key ingredient
making
a good book.
The hystericals.
Oh, yeah. That's perfect.
I mean, hilarious. And yeah. I mean, the fact that right away when I called out the Sherbrooke Bride at the very jump, she was like, yeah, we call those heroes assholes. I mean, we totally do, but,
you know, things are different, but they are also the same.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that there's so much about what she said, especially when she spoke about conferences and the craft mm-hmm. workshops and the this is the only way you can do it and throw everybody else's book out. You only use mine.
Right.
You know, the one thing that seems to run through all of these conversations, I think, to a person is don't let other people's rules impact your book. Your story is your story. And, you know, I hear so often, and you do too, we see it constantly on Twitter and, you know, in writing groups and all over the place, these kind of hard and fast, you must do it this way. You must traditionally publish this way. You must independently publish this way. None of these people followed. I don't think one single person we've talked to for this series has followed the bouncing ball.
Yeah.
They've all had some moment where they've kind of deviated. And,
right.
You know, I had lunch with Hillary Ross and I told her I wanted to put sex in a Regency. And
yeah.
She said, go with it. It made me think so much of Vivian Stevens and how mm-hmm. Vivian just kept saying, like, yeah, do what you do you.
And that's what makes the books good. Mm-hmm. Right.
What a conversation. That was pretty awesome. Life goals.
It's great.
It's great. Catherine's latest book is Reckoning. It came out in August, so it is on shelves now. We will put in show notes all the books that Dan and I have loved by her over the years, or some subset of the books that I have loved over the years by her, because I've loved so many of them. Obviously with the caveat that these are older historicals, so, you know,
enter with caution.
They're gonna be bananas, I can promise that.
Look, if the author was calling them hystericals as she was writing them, then the amplification of that can only be more amazing.
Well, I said with her that I spoke with Sophie Jordan this morning, and we talked about the grovel. Like, she really does it. She knows the job when it comes to a grovel. These heroes have to be broken. Or what did she say? Disciplined?
They like it, though.
The other thing Sophie said to me was talk about taking the finger. And I think that's true. I think anybody, when you dip your toe into these old Catherine Coulter historicals, that's what you're going to get every time. A real take the finger experience.
Perfect.
I'm Sarah McLean. I'm here with my friend Jen Prokop. This is Faded Mates, and you can find us every Wednesday. Thank you, as always, to our sponsors, Lumi Labs and Kara Dion. Be sure to check out Indiscreet, Kara's book, right now in KU or print. Have a great week, everyone.